Joining us today on Crosswinds at 1590 WSMN is the legendary musician Bobby Whitlock, whose new CD, Lovers, with Coco Carmel. Bobby, I am truly honored to have you with us. How are you?
Doing just great these days. It's a whole lot of fun being Bobby Whitlock.
Now, for my listeners who may not know, Bobby Whitlock was a member of the historical band Derek and the Dominoes. Aside from co-writing most of the songs on the album with Eric Clapton, Bobby also provided the powerhouse vocals, piano, and B3 organ on that transcendent record. Before we talk about your new record, Bobby, I've got to know, what was it like to find yourself in Derek and the Dominoes at 19 years old?
Well, so it's kind of one of those things that suddenly you turn around and there you are, you know? I've been playing all over the South and rock and roll, rhythm, blues thing, and that seemed like a fantasy land, a fantasy world, and a dream world. And, you know, I never aspired to, like, be a rock star in a band with Eric Clapton. That, you know, the guys that I revered, you know, were like Steve Crawford, yep. Albert King, you know? I mean, yeah. So that was my thing. And then after, you know, the stint with Delaney and Bonnie, you know, I was the first friend to be there and the last to leave. I've got a never-ending love for you. It was a natural thing to happen, although I didn't know it. As a matter of fact, I called Steve Cropper, and I was living across the street in a house down from Delaney, and I told Steve, I said, I've left Delaney, and I said, I just can't take it anymore, and I said, I haven't got a clue what to do. And I said, I don't want to come back home to Memphis. And he said, hey, man, why don't you call up Eric Clapton and see what he's doing? I didn't even think about that. And I said, well, I haven't got any money to do anything. And he said, you give him a call and see what's up, and then you give me a call and let me know what he says. Well, I called up Eric immediately and told him, I said, hey, man, I'm leaving Delaney and Bonnie. I need to get my head cleared out. And can I just come hang over at your house for a while? I said, what you doing? He said, I'm getting my hair cut. And he said, come on. And I called Cropper, and he said, you have a ticket ready in the morning. They got your passport. I said, yeah. Next morning, there was a cab pulled up, man. I had my airplane ticket and about $150 in my pocket, and off I went to Eric's house. Arrived at Heathrow, and all this took place like a fluid motion, you know.
Amazing.
And I arrived at Heathrow, got a black cab, and it cost me $100 of my money to ride from the airport to his house. I come pulling up, and he went, hey, man, what are you doing? I said, well, you said come on over, and that's what I did. So he opened his door to the house and welcomed me in to his home, and we became fast friends, and we were already fast friends from, you know, he was working with us. And,
yep.
But we became close, and we started writing, and without saying we want to put together a band. As a matter of fact, he had a guy that worked for him, Don, who had one eye, a little bitty guy, kind of reminded you of like Marty Feldman, you know, what honk, you know?
Yep.
But he had a little guy working with him. We went out and had, you know, trucks got food one afternoon, and it was time for me to go back. I'd done run out of money. I didn't have much to spare. And he says, you going back? And I said, as a matter of fact, I had no cash. And he said, I thought we were doing a band together. And I said, well, that was right then was the first mention of us doing it.
That's amazing.
At the truck stop. And we went to his manager's office, and Robert Sigwood, and said, we want to put a rock and roll band together. And he said, well, what do you need? And we told him, and here we are on the phone, you know.
Unbelievable.
It was an incredible experience. It was like, it was me, but it wasn't really me. And it wasn't my time then, you know. Even though it was my part that I played in there, I didn't know until many years later the role that I played in that whole thing. Bell bottom blues.
Let me expand upon that, and I have to thank my dear friends, Rick and Louise. These were friends of ours. We were at a dinner party a few months ago, my wife and I, and the friend Rick brought out a Derek and the Dominoes album, and as I always do, I started on my long tirade about how Bobby Whitlock was the genius behind that band. You know, I fell in love with that album and your gorgeous ballad, Thorn Tree in the Garden.
Thank you so much.
And I found your solo album, and I wore it out twice.
My first one?
Your first one, you know, back home in England, and the song for Paula. It left no doubt in my mind, hearing that your writing style, both musically and lyrically, were really pervasive in the Layla album. I'm sure you're humble about it, but there's no question that record wouldn't have been the same without you.
And you don't know how much I appreciate that. And I'm glad that I've lived to hear that, you know, because I didn't know when I was a young man. I really didn't. I didn't have a clue. I had a house in Ascot and had a Ferrari and the biz, you know? But I was just like, I was going at this kind of like Steve Martin winning comedy with absolutely nothing to back it up, you know?
Just a hat with an arrow through it, like Steve Martin.
That's it, man. I really had nothing to back myself up. I didn't have anybody looking after my business or anything. But I don't know. It's just it was not my time.
In your bio, you said you were raised among river rats, whores, and moonshiners.
Well, you know, my dad was a Southern Baptist Hellfire brimstone preacher, and he was like barely 5 feet tall, and I thought he was like 6 feet tall until I became a man. And he lived in fear and lashed out at the world. His family were from outside of New Albany, Mississippi. If you can imagine something being outside of New Albany, Mississippi,
yeah.
A place called Pumpkin Center. And he was born between two creeks. He was born south of Hell and north of Damnation Creek.
Wow.
In Pumpkin Center, Mississippi. And he had a difficult time rising above his circumstance, even though he was a passionate man about what he did.
Yeah.
And very learned. He could not rise above himself, you know.
But whatever he had, man, he passed it on to you. You've really got the passion. And stay tuned for more of our fascinating interview with Bobby Whitlock coming up after the break. What a guy, and fascinating insight into the how Derek and the Dominoes, his legendary album, all came together quite by accident, kind of, as it turns out.
One of those stories.
One of those great stories.
One of those almost an accident that turned into just genius.
Unbelievable. Bobby Whitlock, Eric Clapton, Dwayne Allman, what a lineup on that record, and it all came about by accident. So join us for more, and you can learn more about Bobby at bobbywhitlock.com. You can buy his new record there, which just released back on Valentine's Day in February. I'm right in the middle of wearing it out already. It's a beautiful record, well worth the buy. If you want some inside record, just something, you know, a record you're not going to hear probably a lot about in the mainstream right away, that's the place to get it, bobbywhitlock.com. You're listening to Crosswinds at 1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk, and today, music history. Back after these brief words. We're talking with Bobby Whitlock here at 1590 WSMN. Bobby also played for George Harrison on the All Things Must Pass album. You played for the Rolling Stones on the epic album Exile on Main Street. And after all that, you said in your bio, you took some time off to be with your family. You released another solo album in 2000 called It's About Time. And then Coco Carmel?
Yes.
Tell me about it, Bobby.
Well, she had left her experience, and I had left mine, and we had been friends for many years, since like 1990. And we left together Mississippi. My farm.
Yeah.
And I was going to help her get her new life started. And she was helping me get my new life started. Next thing you know, here we are. Actually, the only way I can describe it is that it was divinely orchestrated, because neither she nor I could have ever planned our lives to work out this way. You know, it wasn't, certainly wasn't in our mind. When we got together, it just seemed a natural thing for us to be together. Not only personally, as we're soulmates.
I really,
she's the love I never did have, you know?
And it really comes through on this album. You recorded this at Willie Nelson's famed Pedernales studio, and you've got some all-stars playing with you. You want to tell us about the musicians?
Yeah, I'm happy to say that Brandon Temple played drums and James Spinner played percussion, and Coco actually played the bass on this, and the guitar players were David Grissom, Stephen Bruton, and Eric Johnson.
Now what do you do when you get lonely?
And how this thing played out was, we had put together where the guitars was going to be the last thing on. Coco and I had worked with this band last year at the Road to Austin thing, and with Chris Stockton, Dalton Clinton, and Bonnie Raitt. And we did two songs. We did Why Does Love Gotta Be So Sad and Tell the Truth, and you could hear the audience over the everything, but this band was smoking. The best band on the planet, man, I'm telling you right now. And those three guys were awesome. And we did an incredible version of Layla, where it's real laid back, and then it kicks into the chorus, and it lays back again. It kicks in the chorus. It does this three times, and it's using the saxophone, focusing around the saxophone with those seven notes, those same famous notes, Albert
right.
King notes, and then but bust into those guitars with no piano solo. You wouldn't believe it. When it came time to do this record, the opportunity to finish this thing out, I swore, wouldn't it be great if we could get those guys, and we'll have like a Layla day at some given point in time.
Right.
Dave Mason was going to, he wanted to play on the record, all right, but then he couldn't do it. And those guys individually couldn't do it.
Yep.
Stephen was busy doing something, David was busy somewhere else, and he was in jury duty. Eric was off on the road. And the next thing you know, we turn around, and all three can do it, and Dave Mason can't. I said, well, let's have Layla there the first day, because they already know the song.
Yep.
We walked in the studio. I'd already put, you know, both in Dolphin piano and B3, and Coco had done the bass and the sax. You know, we'd already done all the vocals and the business. We just wanted to layer these guitars in. They came in, we plugged up just like on live on the stage, and played at the same time. Awesome. It was absolutely awesome. Second take. First take, most songs. We did Layla was the first song, and we kept the second take. The room levitated. I gotta say, man, it was an incredible experience. And that was the second take. That's the one we kept. There were no overdubs on the thing. They stayed and did, they were going to just do two songs. They stayed and did the whole album, and there were no overdubs. And Willie came in. Actually, Willie was the first guy on the scene. And he did True Love for Coco.
Oh, yeah.
And then Dear Veronica for me. And what can I say? You know, I mean, if we had to sit down and work that out with, like, Bill Graham and some other heavy-duty people got around the table and said, Lennon, we can put this together. Can you do this? Can someone, can you call this guy's manager and this person's manager and all this stuff? Get them all at this one point in time and then this little place. You couldn't have done it.
Right.
Nobody could have done it.
Once again, we're talking with Bobby Whitlock, famed pianist and vocalist for Derek and the Dominoes. His new record is called Lovers. It's a stunning record. You can learn more and get the album at BobbyWhitlock.com.
Yeah, and it's Bobby Whitlock and Coco Carmel.
And both Bobby Whitlock and CocoCarmel.com. Bobby, I really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Carl.
Put your arms around.
And there you go, our interview with the legendary Bobby Whitlock. His new CD, Lovers, just released on Valentine's Day 6 or 7 weeks ago. You can find out more about Bobby at bobbywhitlock.com and bobbywhitlockandcococaramel.com. And highly recommend that you go ahead and buy this record. It's well worth $17 or $18, whatever they get for it. The guy's a legend. Beautiful, beautiful record. And absolute sweetheart of a guy. It was a thrill to talk to him and get a little, for music junkies like me, if you're from my generation, Derek and the Dominoes and the Layla album was a seminal record. Very interesting to see how that came about, kind of by accident. Bobby Whitlock got done with Delaney and Bonnie, and they had been touring with Blind Faith, so he knew Eric Clapton, left Delaney and Bonnie, called Eric Clapton up, said, "What are you doing?" Clapton said, "I'm getting a haircut. Why don't you come to England?" Next thing you know, Bobby's in England. They were having a little lunch at a truck stop, and they said, "Hey, how about doing a record?"
I like the, he went to England with $150 in his pocket, and it cost him $100 to take the cab from the Heathrow to Eric Clapton's house.
Yeah.
So, you know, so he gets out of the plane, "I got $150, it should be good," you know, back then, what, for a week or so, and all of
exactly.
a sudden the cab, it's $100, boom. See
it's hard to believe, isn't it? You know, a lot of guys in the music industry back then, and of course, for those of you who are in tune, you know, we have a Neville Brothers bumper that we play going in here. One of the famous Neville Brothers story, Aaron Neville, who had a hit with the song Tell It Like It Is, and that was back in the early 60s and late 50s, and Aaron says, he goes, "I'd be working on the docks unloading fish for 10 cents an hour listening to my own hit song on the radio station." And, you know, these guys got no money out of it. As was so often the case back in the day, musicians, they didn't have the proper representation, management, and a lot of them just got hammered financially. So glad to see Bobby Whitlock happy, healthy, and playing music again. In the last quarter of the show, we will do our legendary, much-heralded Call Me a Nut segment and our Dirty Rotten News of the Week. We invite you to join the conversation, 603-883-9900.
Let's take calls.
Let's take some calls at 1590 WSMN. Another little interesting story here in national politics. Of course, everyone knows what's going on. Hillary and Obama kind of shooting each other up over different things. Hillary, her big sniper fire, dodging sniper fire in Bosnia, and turns out...
Dodging sniper fire?
Yeah, she was...
trying to pick her off?
Well, that's what she had claimed, but then the video footage of her trip, that trip shows a much different scene where she was...
That's not true!
It was not true at all. She was, she was greeted by... a bunch of young kids at the airport, and they had a little birthday cake and candles glowing. So I don't know what she thought.
Maybe it was firecrackers.
You know what? I think maybe someone was making some microwave popcorn nearby, and she might have mistaken that. That happens to me a lot late at night if I'm making popcorn. That popcorn will start to go, and I'll dive under the kitchen table because the first thing I think naturally
Scary.
Is sniper fire. Sure.
Yeah. You're not in the green zone.
Well,
so.
Who wouldn't think of that? Well, you know, you never know exactly what color zone I'm in at 2 in the morning. Could be green or any other assortment of colors. Rainbow colors usually that time of night, Matt.
Yeah.
I'm usually in the rainbow zone. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Try the veal. In the Defense Department, we're talking about John McCain, who wants to tighten up, among other things. We've talked about it extensively here at Crosswinds, the pork barrel spending, which McCain is a famous crusader against. Another thing he's planning to reel in is the Defense Department budget. Not so much the budget, but the way we get hammered over it. Major weapons systems were $295 million over budget in 2007, and they are delivered an average of 21 months late. McCain says we're going to have a new proposal where the Pentagon wouldn't pay a dime more than a contract specifies, and it would enforce tough best practices standards. In other words, get it done on budget, get it done on time. Our service guys need that stuff, and we need the money. You're listening to Crosswinds with Carl Zahn, 1590 WSMN. This break will be so short you won't even know we were gone, and then it's Call Me a Nut.
Hi, Bill O'Reilly here, and you are listening to Crosswinds with Carl Zahn on 1590 WSMN. WFMN, Nashua's News and Talk.
Joining us today at Crosswinds on 1590 WSMN is New Hampshire Attorney General Kelly Ayotte. Kelly, thanks for being with us. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to be with you, Carl.
I appreciate you taking the time. I'm a big fan of yours for several reasons. First and foremost, you have been a key player in strengthening New Hampshire's laws that protect children in both researching, authoring, and bringing to reality New Hampshire's Tough New Child Protection Act. And now you are working on the internet side of child abuse. This legislation is groundbreaking in many ways. Where are you at in the process?
Well, this is the Online Child Safety Act, and it absolutely builds on the work that we did. Carl, you were instrumental in getting the sexual predator, you know, making sure that we had the harshest penalties for those who prey on our children. And this deals with the internet side of it. Now technology is being used, of course, unfortunately, by predators looking to meet our kids online. And this act that's now going through the legislature is one that I've worked on with the governor and law enforcement. It's going to update our laws to make sure that we have the best laws in place to deal with the updated technology and enhance penalties to deal with people who reach out to kids on the internet looking to have sexual relationships with kids and to harm kids.
It's amazing what's going on the internet. I spoke with Governor Lynch about a month and a half ago about this same subject. Also, Kelly, you and I spoke well over a year ago and discussed trying to reach out to Vermont's lawmakers to see if they may be interested in taking a look at our new child protection laws, and that kind of went nowhere. And for our listeners, you know, the feeling was, as neighboring New England states, we should all pull together. So we thought it was a generous gesture from New Hampshire to say, look, here's this law. We did the heavy lifting. Maybe it works for you. And more recently, you've done the same thing with Massachusetts through Attorney General Martha Coakley. And I understand you spoke with her deputy this week. Do you sense any interest on their part?
I did. I think that they have some interest, and they're also focused on the Adam Walsh law, which is a law that's going through right now, also our legislature, which is going to make all the sex offender registries across the country consistent, because right now the sex offender registries vary from state to state, and unfortunately what it allows is sex offenders who move from state to state to sometimes fall through the cracks. So they are very interested in the issue, and I plan on sending a copy of our bill down to Attorney General Coakley's office and, you know, make ourselves available if they want to speak with us.
Well, I think that's fantastic because Massachusetts, like Vermont, has kind of been behind the curve getting up to speed. We're speaking with New Hampshire Attorney General Kelly Ayotte. Kelly, I've always admired your style. You're aggressive, yet pragmatic and logical from what I can tell. And moreover, I've always sensed that you understand the urgency with some of these issues. I know Governor Lynch does too. I feel we have an uphill battle protecting our kids all across the country, and I think the explosion of child pornography on the internet really,
you know,
doesn't, I think it really lies at the root of much of the problem here, you think?
I got to tell you, Carl, you know, child pornography is so disturbing. This bill that's going through the legislature right now, it's passed the Senate, it's right now in the House, I have every reason to believe it will pass. Really updates our laws dealing with child pornography. It creates separate crimes for possession, distribution, and manufacture of child pornography. In other words, greater penalties for the more serious crimes, and also greater penalties for repeat offenders. We put together a task force last spring of law enforcement in New Hampshire to focus on some of the child pornography being traded on the internet. And I got to tell you, I thought I had heard it all. But some of the images of the people that we arrested as a result of that task force, they were trading in images of child pornography of children that were as young as 3 and sometimes infants being raped. These are real children. So when we talk about child pornography, it's really disturbing stuff.
I think you're getting to a point I was going to make. You know, I've been surprised all along and continue to be at the public apathy over what's going on here. And I don't know I think it's because it's hard to discuss. It's, as you just said, and you put it in graphic terms, but I think people really need to hear the graphic terms. I mean, this is video of young children screaming, crying for their mother, violently being raped.
Oh, I mean, as young as infants. Can you imagine toddlers? It is really sick. And I think from the public's perspective, they maybe don't get a sense of how really disturbing this stuff is.
It really is, and the thing that's disturbing about it is because of the popularity of this on the internet, you have to know that these are people who are standing behind the line at you at the supermarket, they're pumping gas next to you. Mm-hmm. It's really frightening, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist guy or a paranoid, but I want to be aware.
Well, I think you bring up a really good point. We've all had this image, and this goes to, you know, the sexual predators. We have this image that it's some certain looking person who's lurking in the shadows, but unfortunately the reality is that people who are charged with these offenses come from all walks of life. And often when it comes to sexual assaults against children, it's unfortunately people that they know. And so you can't have one stereotype in mind when it comes to protecting your children.
Not at all. And I have to tell you, I was really glad to see a few months ago, I think it's Superior Court Judge Kathleen McGuire. Do I have that name right?
Yes, Judge McGuire.
Right, when she sentenced this New Hampshire man who had been caught with the most horrific child abuse on his computer, and when Judge McGuire sentenced this guy, and she gave him a stiff sentence that New Hampshire should be proud of, but she gave this guy a dissertation on why child pornography is almost as bad as the act itself, because by partaking in this stuff and trafficking in it, you're helping to sustain and create the demand. You're helping to expand this underground culture that feels this stuff is okay. So I was glad to finally, and it's rare, hear a no-nonsense judge underline why this is so such a criminal act.
Yeah, I think that those are such good points. What happens is when you don't take this seriously, it's a market for this stuff, and it creates more of a demand. So in other words, more children being abused, and every time one of those images is downloaded or transmitted, you know, that child's being re-victimized, because can you imagine having your picture out on the internet in these circumstances? You know, it is very, very difficult. And the one thing about the internet, it's made it so much easier to trade in these types of images, because there's file sharing programs now that facilitate, unfortunately, being able to trade in all types of things, but also illegal materials.
I'll tell you, I give you a lot of credit, and with your job, you know, as a guy who watches things and I look around the country, and of course we just had a homicide in Wilton, as you know, right next door to me, and I look around the country just over the past few months, a couple of samples of something is really going on culturally here that's disturbing. The father in Alabama a few months ago who threw his four children off a bridge to their deaths. The woman on Route 495 a few months ago who walked into traffic carrying her niece and nephew. There's just this kind of unwinding of our social fabric that concerns me, and I'm not sure what's driving it. Do you sense the same thing?
I do, and I always wonder if it's because of the nature of my job, but I certainly see these things, and we're going to be measured by what we can do for our children.
I agree. I appreciate your service to our state, and I appreciate you being with us, and I certainly hope you feel better.
Well, thank you, Carl. I hope you can have me on when I don't have a cold, because I would love to talk to you more about these issues.
We'll have you on again, and we'll be watching as all these things progress. Thanks again,
Excellent.
Kelly.
Excellent. Take care.
Okay, Kelly Aya talking about the proposed legislation against child pornography on the internet, as well as some other issues. This issue with the proposed study of the death penalty, Kelly Ayotte, as I believe she mentioned, is worried about the implications of this commission studying our death penalty, just as the state is bringing forth these two very important murder trials, the first being Michael Addison, who was the alleged murderer of Manchester patrolman Michael Briggs. That's coming to trial shortly, and also a gentleman named, say a gentleman, Jay Brooks. He was a wealthy CEO who was indicted in June 2005 of the kidnapping murder of an associate, Jack Reed, whose body was found in Saugus, Mass. Two high-profile murder cases coming up in New Hampshire where the death penalty is being sought. And now, suddenly, there's legislation to bring a commission forth to study the death penalty. Kelly Ayotte has said that she's concerned the study commission itself and the way it is framed will directly interfere with the Addison and Brooks cases. And you can well imagine that defense attorneys will see some kind of conflict here with this commission going forth and these two trials. And, you know, I'd hate to lose one of these trials. Manchester Police Lieutenant Nick Willard has been the lead detective on the Addison case since Officer Briggs fell to his death. Quote, "We lost one of our best men that night, and many of us have not recovered from it, including yours truly," Willard told the Senate Judiciary Committee about this House-approved bill. "My chief concern with this is, why now? I question the whole motive of trying to engage in a study while we are considering two capital murder cases." And I have to agree with Officer Willard that it almost seems as though there is some underhanded motive here. Roman Catholic Bishop John McCormick is one of the people who is behind this and has taken some grief from A.G. Kelly Ayotte over it. You know, we haven't visited this subject since 1973. Why now, suddenly? We can't wait 6 months until we get two murder trials under the way and then do this commission. Something's going on here, folks, and you'll be hearing more about this story, I can guarantee you. Following a brief break, we will have our nationally acclaimed Call Me a Nut segment and more about my producer, Matt Late, also known apparently on the internet as Mr. Hot Dog. It's Crosswinds with Carl Zahn, 1590 WSMN. And welcome back to Crosswinds with Carl Zahn at 1590 WSMN. As promised, I am delighted, frightened, and generally exhilarated to introduce our next guest, former Nashua resident and native and world-renowned glass artist Rick Ayotte. Rick, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Why do you sound so pensive?
Pensive?
Yeah, pensive.
Because I'm sitting in my chair with my feet up on the desk.
I bet you are. I have a martini going there?
No, it's too early for that.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Yeah.
Rick, you and I go back a long way. My late father, I'll give my audience a little background here. My late father, who ran an import-export and gift distributorship business, bought little glass figures and animals from Rick back in, let's see, I was 18, I think, when I used to come down to your Lake Street warehouse. I was a punk. I know you didn't like me much then, and I used to be frightened when I would go to pick up stuff because I would walk into this warehouse, and it was kind of like a scene from Silence of the Lambs. Rick would be over there with his big blowtorch and a bunch of glass. And you remember those days, Rick?
Yes, I remember those days. But I want to go on the record. I've never not liked you. I've always liked you.
No, I know that.
I think the world of your family and your late dad especially.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, my dad, and I say this completely honestly, my dad really did love you. And I spoke with my mother this morning and told her that I was going to be talking to you, and she wanted me to pass on her best wishes to you as well. So I know
that's very kind. She's a wonderful lady.
Well, and your family is wonderful as well, and I really have always enjoyed your sense of humor. And Rick has just an incredible work ethic. I used to marvel at the speed that he used to do these things. And so what I wanted to talk to you about first, Rick, is how did you end up in glass originally? Because that's kind of an unusual place to go.
Well, I graduated from high school in 1962, and I really didn't have enough money to go to college or anything like that. So I looked around for a trade, and I tried a few different things, and somebody... a neighbor of mine said there was a truck driving job at McAllister Scientific, which is across from Edgecombe Steel in Nashua. It was there, anyways. And
yep.
It sounded like a place where, you know, they had glass blowing and stuff. It sounded very interesting. So a guy had seen me work at the AMP and knew that, you know, I was a decent worker. So he hired me, and I would sit at the benches during lunch and breaks, and and work on the torches and show an interest. And anyway, 6 months later, I was on the bench learning glass blowing, and I was addicted, and I liked it very much, scientific glass blowing. And so I started my own little shop at home, and 9 years later, I opened my novelty business, which I sold to your dad and everything. And I did that for 6 years, and then I was introduced to a new art form in 1975, whereas they were taking colored soft glass and putting it in molten crystal, and the design, of course, would be in there forever. And I was lucky to catch it in its infancy, and I've been doing that particular art form full-time now for 37 years. It's quite challenging, and it's always changing and very interesting, so I have my hands full doing it, and I enjoy doing it.
And do you have a website or something like that where people can go to see your work?
Yeah, let me look it up because
all right, well,
I work all the time, and my wife and daughter do the website.
All right, well, we can...
Oh, I got it right here.
Okay.
AyotGlassArt.com.
Ayot, A-Y-O-T-T-E, GlassArt.com.
Right, right.
Okay. And because I know that these things you're doing now are pretty high-end stuff, correct? And you sell kind of to all over the world?
Yes. We do make high-end stuff that we do sell all over the world. My work is in about 14 museums right now. Kind of a weird thing when you're still alive, but like I said, I caught a new art form and I moved and worked very hard at it. In fact, the Currier Museum in Manchester, New Hampshire has, I believe, 7 or 8 of my pieces on exhibit right now, and they have a number of them in the back room. They keep changing and stuff, and I'm very honored to be in there because I really like that museum.
Well, and that's a hard place to get. And didn't you say, do you have stuff on display at a few other places?
Well, I have a display show going on at the Sandwich Glass Art Museum, Sandwich Glass Museum in Sandwich, Massachusetts right now. About 130 of my pieces are there on display till the end of this month. And as far as museums, almost all the big ones, Corning, Smithsonian, the Chicago Art Institute, Victoria and Albert in England.
Wow.
All of the Royal Ontario Museum in Canada. Anyways, it's a weird thing.
Good for you. Well, I'll tell you, I was always fascinated, truly, at the work you did down there. It's hard to even describe to my listeners the speed that you used to turn these things out at, these very, very intricate little things. And each one, of course, they're handmade, so each one is a little bit different, but really almost identical. I really used to be fascinated at watching you work. And I'm glad that you found this... this kind of little niche that really let you make a decent living at it. And,
well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, listen, I really admire people, and I mean this truly, that make their living in the arts, whether it's music, writing, anything like that, or what you do. I think it's so important to our culture, really, really maybe now more than ever, that these things that are really at the base of human emotion and who we are. You know, I mean, you try to imagine a world without people like yourselves, creative people, and it would be pretty boring. I also wanted to touch upon, because I know our listeners, you might imagine, Rick, my listening audience, pretty smart people, pretty smart crowd.
Well, I would think that they're mm-hmm. brilliant, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brilliant. I don't think that would be too much. We had spoke last week. I know that my brilliant listeners are going, Ayot, Ayot, Ayot. And yes, Rick is indeed uncle to the best thing that ever happened to New Hampshire Attorney General Kelly Ayotte,
mm-hmm.
who I spoke with last week, by the way. And I noticed when I spoke with you last week and I mentioned Kelly, you said she ought to find something to do. I think that's what you said.
I said she should get a life if she's, you know, she's going to be listening to me Sunday.
Oh, get a life. I see, because I was going to say she's... I see an overachiever streak in the Ayotte family. And, of course, I also know your son and his wife, Wendy, in Milford. Rick's son, Dan, is an air traffic controller here in the city. So just a wonderful family all the way around. And it's ayotglassart.com.
Right.
And you've got stuff in display, and it sounds like practically every museum in the country.
Well, not every museum. It's quite a few, but a lot of the bigger ones and stuff, and some smaller ones and whatever. it's just one of those freaky things that I happen to catch at the right time, like I said, you know. But, you know, art is really hard work. It's thinking about it all the time.
It is.
It's working at it all the time. I'm working today.
I know you are. In fact, I should tell my list.
It's an addiction.
It is. I'm sure it is. And you know what? You're right about it, because people ask me about the writing, and I've done some stand-up comedy, and I used to play music, and all of it is... It is work, you know.
Creativity is hard work.
Creativity is hard work. In fact, I let my listeners know we actually had originally planned on pre-recording this interview because Rick had lied to me and told me he was going to be at his home in Canada
weekend. I just didn't tell you the truth.
I know. You're right. That's a difference. Obviously, you've got the Bill Clinton manual of, yeah.
Yes, I do. Thank you.
But so anyways, we called Rick at 3:15 on Friday and picked it up. He goes, I'm making a paperweight. I'm not ready. And then we called back at 3:30. He goes, I'm still not done with my paperweight. And then we called back at 4:15. And I said, you know, before I make this guy damage a $5,000 paperweight, I'm just going to hang up. So we decided to do it live. And before I go, Rick, I want to tell you, and I don't say this to make you nervous, but I'm coming out with a line of paperweights myself.
I hope so. Well, I'm more into the, just paperweights. I do a lot of different types of art glass, too.
Well, we're going to...
All in the enclosing technique.
We're going to plug your
That was a $6,500 piece, not a $5,000 piece.
Okay, thanks for correcting me. I wanted to tell you, my paperweight, it's a little rock with a Z painted on it.
Okay. Well, don't get me going. I'm getting jealous. I get jealous very easily.
I don't want to make you nervous, but in fairness, I want to let you know.
That's great.
There's some competition around the corner.
Yeah, I could use the break.
Rick, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I'm going to let you go, and I really appreciate you giving me the time today. I know you're a busy guy.
My pleasure, and it's nice to hear from you.
Well, I will, and I'm going to pass on your greetings to my mother, and like I said, it's been... Mm-hmm. Really a privilege and a pleasure knowing your family and knowing you folks all these years, and we wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you.
All right.
I've already had a lot of luck, but any more, I can use more.
You know what? You've always been a little greedy with luck that.
I've noticed. I really have worked hard at being lucky.
I know you
have.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks, Rick. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. That was Rick Ayotte, ladies and gentlemen. Check out this website, ayotteglassart.com, A-Y-O-T-T-E, glassart.com.
Stuff's very nice. I'm looking at it right now.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? I mean, I'm telling you, I'm not kidding when I say this guy is just incredibly talented, and to call him a hard worker is just an understatement, and... it does run in the family. Like I said, he is the uncle of New Hampshire Attorney General Kelly Ayotte, of whom I think the world. And just a wonderful family and a Nashua native. Lived here in Nashua for years and years and years and listened to WSMN 1590 probably since they started way back in 1958. Joining us at Crosswinds today at 1590 WSMN is author Lynn Spencer. Lynn is a pilot for ExpressJet Airlines as well as a certified flight instructor. She's been a commercial pilot for 11 years and in that time has held the coveted position of instructor for the airline. She graduated from Duke University with honors before becoming a pilot, and she completed her high altitude training at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. Lynn is also a member of the National Security Committee for the Airlines Pilots Association, a committee that works closely with the TSA, the Department of Homeland Security, the FAA, and the FBI on all issues having to do with aircraft safety and security and initiatives. She is also a member of the Threatened Airspace Management Subcommittee. Lynn, thanks for being with us today. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing just fine.
As a private pilot myself, we share, obviously, a love for aviation. One of the things I have always, in discussing that fateful day of September 11th, 2001, with friends, I have always been in awe of how our air traffic control system handled that day. But it was not until your book came out that I realized a lot of kind of misconceptions, I think, that the general public had about what went on that day.
Oh, I think you're correct. I think in going right to the people and getting their stories and telling the stories is seen through their eyes, what they heard and what they saw. You see a whole different perspective.
I'm sure you do. I noticed some really interesting points in your book here, and as I said, I've always been amazed at how ATC stepped up that day. I guess where we're both pilots, we're both familiar with that kind of subculture of air traffic control. They are our friends in the sky and always there when we need them. It's just an amazing for all the weak points that you know, people gripe a lot about the kind of airline industry in general, but we have, without a doubt, one of the best systems in the world. One of the things that struck me in your book, and something that I never knew until your book, that this gentleman, Ben Sliney, who is the National Operations Manager for the FAA Command Center, it was his first day on the job.
Yes, it was. Can you imagine? It was the first day on the job as the man in charge of the National Airspace System. And just hours into his shift, he has to shut everything down for the first time in history. It had never been done, and he didn't even wait on orders from up above.
It's truly amazing to me, and I'll tell you, that's a fact that I never knew, and I don't think that got much, if any, media play.
And it really touched me when I talked to the man. He said as he was looking up at the screen at the front of the command center that shows all the planes flying across the country, and he said, I realized they were all potential missiles. And when he turned to give the order to get everything on the ground, he knew that this is my first day on the job and might very well be my last, but they are coming out of the sky.
Well, those are the kinds of instant decisions that people are trained to make in that line of work. Coincidentally, we're just as we speak, we are only a few miles from Boston Center, as you know, in Nashua, New Hampshire. It's right next door to the airport I fly out of.
I know a lot of heroes there.
There are a lot of heroes there, and because I have a handful of friends who are controllers, I've had the privilege of being over there maybe half a dozen times and seeing that operation. It's truly amazing, but knowing that day, what must have been going on there, especially myself, that's one of those days that most Americans remember where they were and what they were doing when we heard that news. And one of the first things that I thought about was the, you know, what must have been going through minds over there at Boston Center.
Well, and they were so brave, and I think most of America doesn't realize how much happened there at Boston Center in Nashua. Those pilots those controllers there were the only controllers to issue warnings to the pilots. That's unheard of in the industry. Controllers have never just issued a broad warning to secure the cockpit, but they did there at Boston Center that day. Their call to Otis Air National Guard base on Cape Cod gave the pilots their advance notice so that when the scramble order came down, the pilots were already in their cockpits, ready to launch. Saved precious minutes of response time.
Absolutely amazing. And, you know, people, of course, once again, because, of course, you're very experienced in aviation. I've been flying about 20 years. A lot of people don't realize, I mean, air traffic control is a stressful job on a good day. Mm-hmm. And given what happened that day, and another thing that your book shines a light on, again, that I was ignorant of, is that these folks had no command from the higher levels for over an hour, including Donald Rumsfeld. Isn't that stunning?
Well, it is, but I think that's partly because the attacks really were so unprecedented. We hadn't anticipated anything like it, so every area, whether it was in the control towers at the air traffic control facilities or command centers or even in the military and at the highest levels, they were all trying to get a sense of what exactly is happening, how broad is this threat, and some of the key communication lines weren't, they didn't exist at the time. There was no way for NORAD to communicate with the FAA at that time.
Yeah, that's amazing and kind of frightening. I mean, I remember myself on a very personal level thinking that day as the news unfolded, you know, first the crashes at the World Trade Center and then what was going on in Washington and, of course, United 93. And at one point, you know, wondering, you know, how big a day is this going to be? I mean, how many more are there going to be? And in your book, you say, and this is contrary to the 9/11 Commission's report. I won't comment on their findings because, as we all know, there could be a large lapse between findings and what finds its way into a public report. But you say in your book, and you researched this just so extensively, I'm really impressed with it, that contrary to that report, there were hijackers on other flights that day.
Yeah, there were, and it was the quick thinking of the airport personnel, the airport management, the airlines who were, you know, individually issuing orders to stop all takeoffs, and at the FAA, stopping all takeoffs and demanding that all planes land. All those things put together, you know, saved lives, and even the military's quick response in sending up combat air patrols.
Absolutely stunning. We're talking with author Lynn Spencer, whose new book, Touching History, just released June 3rd, available in bookstores now. I recommend it highly. It's a real inside look at what went on in the skies and on the ground in air traffic control and NORAD that day. And I have always maintained that feat of getting every aircraft on the ground. Once again, people who probably aren't versed in aviation don't realize what a feat that was. It was just incredible. And then I remember, again, on a personal level, for the days after that, my family lives, not surprisingly, underneath an instrument approach to Manchester Airport, so I can watch airplanes at night go in and out. And I remember the airiness of the silence for the weeks that followed 9/11. It was just really odd not to hear any airplanes in the sky.
It was. And as a pilot, I can remember that same feeling. And also the realization that for the first time in history, the military owned the sky. It was odd.
It was odd. Another issue in your book here, and I think, again, I had never heard it publicly, when they scrambled these jets from Otis Air Force Base, the flight that was going out to intercept United 93 was unarmed.
Well, now the Otis fighters were all fully armed. They were part of our alert mission.
Okay.
The fighter pilot that was sent out to intercept United 93 came from the D.C. Air National Guard at Andrews Air Force Base.
Okay, I'm sorry.
From a training mission. No, that's okay.
This is Major Joe McGrady, correct?
No, actually, Joe McGrady, his story, he did leave Otis unarmed. That's the one you're talking about. Sure. He was launched to pick up a target that was coming in, believe it or not, they thought, to Boston Center right there in Nashua.
Uh-huh.
And somehow it was confirmed that it was a hijacked airliner coming in from overseas targeting Boston Center. And this fighter pilot was sent up from Otis. He realized he was unarmed. They had not had time to arm his plane. And as he's racing toward this target that he's already been told, you're going to need to shoot that target down, he's thinking of his kids. In fact, that day, September 11th, was the sixth-week checkup for his baby twins.
Wow.
And he's fighting out, he's flying out to this target. He said he was taking turns screaming at the top of his lungs, praying and reciting Hail Marys one after another, just in his fury over the evil in the world and his fate as a soldier, because he knew he was going to have to probably use his own plane as a weapon.
Yeah, that's just an incredible story right there. An amazing day overall. God, I just can't recommend this book highly enough. The book is Touching History. The author is Lynn Spencer. She's a pilot herself. As a pilot, and somewhat unrelated to the book, I have to ask you, what was the high altitude training like in Houston?
Oh, God. You know, when you have an explosive decompression at 35,000 feet, what I didn't realize is you can't breathe at first. The pressure differential is so great, you really can't. It's like being punched in the stomach, but it was a thrill.
I've also heard it's a really good way to clean the airplane.
Of everything.
That's a stolen line from an airline pilot friend of mine, by the way. But well, Lynn, listen, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Who knows? Maybe we'll run into each other at an airport diner someday.
That would be a pleasure.
I think the world of you, and of course the brotherhood of anyone that flies, and the sisterhood in your case. We all share that common love for aviation. The book is Touching History. I recommend it highly. The author is Lynn Spencer. Lynn, Godspeed, and we'll see you in the friendly skies.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Lynn Spencer, Touching History. I can't recommend this book highly enough. Very interesting stuff. A lot of stuff you don't know, that in fact there were other terrorists on other airplanes that day. The fact that a jet had been scrambled unarmed to intercept Flight 93, and that pilot's outlook, knowing that had he been called upon to do what he was going to have to do, it was going to cost him his life without question. He had to take down that airplane with his airplane. So a lot of fascinating stuff going on. It's Crosswinds with Carl Zahn at 1590 WSMN. More of Crosswinds on the way with author and child advocate Wendy Murphy coming right up.